You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
April 15th marks the first anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. As I'm sure you remember, the historic race was brought to a standstill for the first time in its 117-year history when two homemade bombs exploded near the finish line. Three people lost their lives. Dozens more were gravely injured. Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell covered the story for the Boston Globe, and now they have given us a comprehensive history of the bombings and their aftermath in a book called Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery, and The Epic Hunt for Justice. It's published by Dutton. I'm very pleased that it brings Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Now, Jenna, you were assigned to cover the race, weren't you?
I was not at the race that day, but was actually working on a different story away from the city and learned about this the way that many people did through social media with great shock.
And you too, Scott?
I was nowhere near it. I was buying plants for the spring. And one of the things I will never forget about this is being at a Home Depot, getting a text from my wife, and you see everybody with their smartphones at Home Depot gradually, their eyes gravitating down them, and you can almost feel in the store this sense of these sagging faces. You could really see it happening.
So since neither of you were there, you were the ideal candidates to cover the story.
In a sense, that's true. I mean, I think Jenna ended up spending a lot of time covering it, covering the aftermath. And I had done a book before on Mitt Romney. And so the two skill sets fit nicely together.
And did you work as a team?
Very much so. Yeah.
We did. We went out and did our own reporting and connected with people. Then we would come back together and talk about the project and where we wanted it to go.
Well, what can you do in a book that you couldn't have done in your daily reporting in the newspaper?
Well, the book builds upon a foundation that was built, of course, in those first days and weeks after the bombing by our incredibly talented colleagues who covered this story like nobody else did. But we saw an opportunity, and our editors did, to bring the story together and go deeper and to tell it in a different way.
Well, there has to be some kind of a challenge because people think they know this story.
I've been really struck by the people who have read it, who have said that, you know, I lived this, I remember it, it wasn't that long ago, and I learned so much from this. And I think that has told me that there's a real value in just pulling a massive story together into one place and making it a digestible read. You know, I think we all know it, but we don't know it as well as we think we do.
And you tell the story from the point of view of several key characters, a trauma surgeon, a police officer, a race official, a victim, and the people who knew the bombing suspects. You also tell some of the story from the perspective of the Tsarnaev brothers. How could you know what they were thinking as these events unfolded?
We don't know what they were thinking, and but part of our job as journalists, of course, is to try and look for the why, even when it seems clear that there is no clear answer to that question. So with a great deal of help and support from our colleagues who traveled to Dagestan multiple times on this story, we tried as much as we could to probe deeply into their family history, to look closely at their time in America, about 10 years, which really was a process of disintegration.
Scott, don't members of the family back in Asia still think that this was a setup by the CIA?
I mean, there are those members of the family, sure, but there's also his, you know, their Americanized uncle who called them losers and was actually very helpful, I think, to authorities and so forth. So I think that's very much a fringe opinion, and one we try to not even give that much credence to in the book because, you know, the idea that this is somehow set up is ridiculous.
Did everyone want to talk about them, everyone who knew them?
No, I think there was a lot about this book that was tough in terms of getting people to talk. I mean, remember that we're talking about a time frame here a few months, even weeks really after the bombing, and we're going into people's lives, both those, you know, who were hurt and those connected to the suspects and saying, tell me everything you know. And so, no, I mean, it was a very tough sled on both sides.
Well, they're from Chechnya, and I would assume that they would have some anger directed at Russia. But did you find anything that explained why they did this?
There's not a totally clear answer to why. They came to this country with a lot of dreams for their children and hopes and saw those fall apart over a period of time. marital strife, health problems, problems with the law. The parents eventually left and left their sons kind of to their own devices, increasing anger and radicalism.
You refer to the Tsarnaevs in the book as homegrown terrorists, seemingly assimilated in America, but harboring a latent hatred for it. Did you come up with any tangible reasons for that hatred?
I think one of the things that is a significant moment in their lives is Tamerlan's boxing career. This is the older brother. He was a great boxer, and I think his family had very high hopes for his success in the ring. And they were, I think, genuinely believing he was worthy of the Olympics and so forth. There was a rules change in the Golden Gloves competition that he was part of that said you had to be a citizen, essentially. And he was not a citizen.
And couldn't he have applied for citizenship?
He could have, but I think the time that that happened, it was, you know, you're either a citizen or you're not. And I think that when that door closed to him, he had nothing else to turn to.
Still, hatred doesn't always lead people to commit acts of violence, especially against innocent victims.
And I think that's what's the hardest to understand, right? There's a lot of stories of immigrant families who come to America and they don't make it. It doesn't turn out how they think it's going to turn out. And yet, how do you get from that to committing such a heinous act? I think that is the question that as much as we know about them, is still largely unknowable.
And in the book, you seem to conclude that the Tsarnaevs clung to their religion because life in the United States was stressful and unwelcoming. Wasn't Dzhokhar seen as an easygoing, free-spirited college kid with lots of friends? That doesn't sound like he would have felt all that unwelcomed.
It's interesting to look at the two brothers and their different experiences. There was an age difference between them that I think we feel was just enough for one to be quite assimilated and the other, the older brother, Tamerlan, to not feel that way. And at some point, it seems clear that the younger brother came under the influence of his older brother.
But you're right. I mean, that's one of the most puzzling things about this story, and it was very why it was so shocking to Dzhokhar, the younger brother's friends, because he was the moppy-haired, pot-smoking college kid who played video games. He was a captain of the wrestling team. There was nothing overtly in his profile that suggests that he would be on this path.
Well, I guess this is something that will be addressed during the trial.
I certainly hope so, because I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the why and the motivations, and I'm hoping that we will find out more about, you know, people that they may have spoken to. There's evidence along the way that we are not privy to now.
Do we have any indication that they had connections to other terrorist groups like al-Qaeda?
So far as we know, no. I mean, they were certainly inspired by them. One of the clerics whose videos they were watching was Anwar al-Awlaki, who, you know, has, of course, received a great deal of attention in U.S. intelligence circles. And we know they were watching videos and inspired by them, directed in some active way. We don't have that link.
My guests are Scott Hillman and Jenna Russell, reporters for the Boston Globe. Their book, Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. Why was law enforcement initially reluctant to call the attacks an act of terrorism?
I think that there was that first day, certainly, there was so much that wasn't known. I mean, the investigation was barely launching as night was falling on that Monday. So I think there was a degree of caution.
Well, there also seems to be a fair degree of ineptitude, at least the way you describe how the investigation went initially. For example, the brothers stayed in the area long after the bombing. It hadn't even made a plan for a getaway. I'm guessing that they may have thought that they'd be caught right away.
Yeah, it's very puzzling to get into their heads after the bombing. I mean, one of the most chilling details is you have Dzhokhar going back to campus a day or two after this happens.
As if nothing had happened.
He's at the gym. He's chatting with his friends. He goes to this dinner that's attended by some members of this soccer team. I mean, it's really alarming to think about him being in these people's midst a couple of days after doing something. And that, to me, is one of the indications that, for all we know about Dzhokhar coming under the influence of the older brother, clearly he had some sociopathic tendencies if he's doing that himself.
And what about Tamerlan? Do we know what he was doing at that time?
We know very little about where Tamerlan was. I think the authorities do have some information about that. They've been very unwilling to talk about it. But there is certainly some hole in that story. Where did he go after the bombing? There was a receipt that was found where one of them had shopped at a Whole Foods nearby. But beyond that, we don't know much about his whereabouts until Thursday.
Media coverage after the marathon was around the clock. Watching TV coverage, it felt as though every little bit of evidence was worthy of hours of discussion. And yet, Jenna, they seemed to miss an awful lot. It reminds me now of what's happened with this Malaysian airliner and the obsessing over details that turn out to absolutely not have any real connection to what happened.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of distraction that was going on that week, and it seemed in the moment to take forever for them to figure out what was happening or who might be behind it. But looking back now, I think it's easier to understand what they were doing. They were combing through a great deal of surveillance video and trying to find something that would catch their eye. They found that. They did find that, but it took them some time.
And there was a lot of misinformation, a lot more than just that New York Post's front page.
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, that was part of the reason, I think, why they were so adamant about putting out the photos of the guys they really wanted, because there was so much online speculation. People were comparing photos on Reddit. On Reddit, the Post had that thing about, Bagman was their headline, isolating the wrong guys, which, they later turned out to file a lawsuit. I mean, there was such a rush to want to know who was behind this. And I think that, combined with the tremendous amount of smartphones at the finish line, that's a very toxic mix.
Well, what does it mean for reporters who are covering this story? Because you have to sift through all of that misinformation and real information and determine what story to tell.
It was very, very challenging that week because we had so many reporters out there in the field all over the city and the country sending us information constantly, everything they could uncover. And then back in Boston, it was our job to sort through all of that, as you say, and try to figure out what story we needed to tell.
Why was there a reluctance to release their photos at the beginning?
So there was a big debate behind the scenes. Once they had identified these guys privately, there were two schools of thought. The FBI team thought they wanted to keep it private because the FBI likes to build a case. They like to build the strongest case, go and make the arrest. They want to know, try to find out who they are before going public. The Boston police leadership really wanted to put the photos out there. They were concerned about public safety. They wanted this to come to an end. They wanted to get tips from people. Ultimately, the Boston police view won out. And I think in no small part because of all this speculation that was going on, the FBI wanted to say, ignore all this stuff you're seeing, these other photos. These are the guys we want.
But the FBI had flagged Tamerlan Tuneyev's internet activity for potential associations with militants and then didn't pursue it. He was considered a minimal threat. How could he have slipped through the cracks? And considering what we know now about the NSA's surveillance, and how could he have slipped through the NSA's attention?
I mean, it is remarkable. It's another case of not connecting the dots, which, there have been comparisons made to 9/11. That was one of the big problems there, where you have these silos of information in different agencies. I think that's a case here as well, where there were certainly some red flags. Obviously, it's easier in hindsight to say, oh, we should have paid more attention to this guy. But there were clear warning signs. And the Boston Police Commissioner, for one, was very critical of the decision not to share with him the fact that this person exists in his city or near his city.
So the FBI and the Boston Police were not getting along all that well? They weren't working well together?
No, I think they were. I genuinely think, you've covered a lot of these kinds of stories too. The turf wars among law enforcement agencies can be amazing and quite dispiriting. By all accounts, that did not happen in this case. There was a very early decision to give this investigation to the FBI, let them take control. And I think it actually was quite seamless that week.
Shouldn't some of the behavior of Tamerlan and Zokar have raised red flags?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, something went wrong here because there was some sort of communication breakdown, I think. Not to say that it could have been prevented, but it seems that there was more that could have been done.
My guests are Jenna Russell and Scott Hellman, reporters for the Boston Globe. They have collaborated on a book called Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. It is published by Dutton, which I think is originally a Boston imprint, wasn't it? It was a publishing house in Boston in the days when Boston did most of the publishing, because I think it goes back to 1852. At least that's what it says on the book.
I think that's right.
Anyway, we'll take a little break and we'll come back with more right after this. We are back with Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell, reporters for the Boston Globe. Their book, Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. It's published by Dutton. You spoke to a lot of other people who were involved, witnesses, runners, spectators, first responders, family members. And do they does their story altogether give us a more complete sense of what happened that day?
I think it does. And I think one of the things we really tried to do with this book, above everything else, because it's such a massive story, we wanted to really give people a core group of characters that they could follow. Right, so we wanted to tell the story through the eyes of five principal people who lived it. And that, you know, because it's there are so many disparate voices, so much happened during that week, it's overwhelming. And you need a vehicle, I think, to sort of understand that. And so these five people became our way to tell that story.
And one of them is Heather Abbott.
Right. Heather was at the marathon with her friends. They would go every year. She was standing at the door of a restaurant waiting to get in when she heard the first explosion and turned and looked. And her first thought actually was of 9/11. She didn't even understand why that thought would come into her head. 12 seconds passed. The second bomb exploded close by Heather, and she was badly injured.
Well, she lost a leg. 16 people lost legs in the bomb blast. What was it about her that made her story so compelling that you would want to tell it?
Heather's story is really interesting. She got to the hospital, and the surgeons were able to save her leg, save her foot that night. And so she woke up Tuesday morning, and she believed that she had been spared, that she was one of the lucky ones. And over the course of that week, what happened was deterioration in her condition and ultimately a decision that she herself had to make about whether to keep the leg.
Well, one of the other people you write about is David King. He had run the entire marathon, and then he wound up racing to Mass General to help treat badly injured bombing victims. He must have been working totally on adrenaline.
I think he was. I think he went home, he grabbed his scrubs and a banana. I mean, literally got home from the marathon, grabbed his scrubs and a banana, went right to the hospital, and wasn't home for a while after that. And, you know, the value of him for us was a window into Boston's medical community, which, of course, is among the best in the world. And we really wanted to bring that story to light. And despite all the awful things that we had to put in the book, we wanted to show some of the wonderful things that happened, too. And he gave us a chance to do that.
Well, he'd also served as a doctor in Iraq. And he compared the carnage at the finish line to what he'd seen in combat zones.
He walked into the emergency room that day, and he took one look that scanned across five or six patient bays where patients from the marathon were waiting. And in those few seconds, he said there was not a single doubt in his mind that these were IEDs that had been at the finish line. He could tell by the damage.
So his experience as a trauma surgeon in Iraq obviously was invaluable in treating these people.
It was. It was. It really informed him. He had so much experience doing this. And so he was able to make the kind of split-second decisions that he had to do.
One of the other people you write about is one of the people who died, Crystal Campbell. And you write that her death became an emblem of Boston's sorrow. What did she represent?
Crystal is one of those every-woman characters that you see in Boston, hardworking from a working-class family just outside of Boston, worked in some cases 70 or 80 hours a week, got close to graduating from college but didn't quite finish. She worked in the restaurant business. And, you know, every death and every grievous injury in this case was its own emblem in a sense. But, you know, her wake and her funeral, that was one of the first times that people had the ability to kind of come out and publicly grieve after this horrible week. And so I think she and this was difficult for her parents to really understand and come to terms with, that she was their daughter, she was, you know, their friend, their colleague, what have you, but she did sort of belong to the city in that way. And the lines outside the funeral home and outside the church, I think, really spoke to how deeply everybody felt her loss.
These days, there's a lot of talk about how the public winds up also getting involved in reporting the news. Was that helpful at all?
Well, it could be helpful. It certainly,
because there were a lot of theories that were popping up as a result.
There was a huge amount of speculation, particularly online, and as we've talked about, a lot of confusion and, in some cases, very damaging to innocent people.
And then one of America's great intellectuals, Glenn Beck, named someone as a possible bombing suspect. He has continued to question this man's innocence even after he was cleared by the FBI. The man is suing him.
Yeah, there was a young Saudi kid in 20 or 21 years old who was injured, actually, in the bombing. And he was very much the object of suspicion for hours afterward. FBI agents in his hospital room as he's recovering, they were looking through his Facebook account. This stuff spread online. You know, lots of people reported that they had gone to his apartment north of Boston. They never arrested him, and I think, you know, generally speaking, the authorities handled it okay. But he felt very much violated by this, and I think, you know, the Glenn Beck thing is probably the most egregious example that I know of.
Although whenever something like this happens, there's always a conspiracy theory or two or three. We still have a bunch of people who don't believe that 9/11 was perpetrated by the people who we very definitely did it.
Yeah,
I don't know how else to say that.
It's shocking. We were just talking about this yesterday, and I think very hard for some of the victims and the families to deal with, because even though they can tell themselves that these are just fringe people, they're crazy, to see somebody actually take the time to write something online, to question their injuries, to say this never happened, you're making it up. I mean, it's hugely damaging.
And these are people who are living every day in an altered reality without a leg, learning to navigate the world again. And so to have someone question whether that reality is real is just very disconcerting.
Well, but we've seen similar things recently with the Newtown Creek shootings, where some people have claimed that was all a media hoax designed to get the police to take people's guns away.
Yeah, it's awful, and you will find these people who sort of crawl out of the woodwork at any tragedy. And I, you know, again, in the book, we tried to devote very little attention to that because we just didn't feel like they were worth it.
Well, what was the response of the local Muslim community? Did they feel maligned in the way that Saudi kid did?
I think they were bracing for, in the days after this, I think they were bracing for, you know, kind of a here we go again situation. You know, interestingly, this time we tell a couple of stories in the book about how this mosque that Tamerlan attended, that he would have these outbursts. You know, the mosque would talk about Martin Luther King as somebody that they were holding up as a positive example. You know, he doesn't understand why they're talking about this non-Muslim in this way. When he goes to the local halal meat shop and they have, you know, a halal turkey for Thanksgiving, he's outraged that they are deigning to celebrate an American holiday. So, you know, in this case, in some ways, the mosque community anyway, some of them come across as much more moderate and more restrained and certainly more assimilated than he was.
Well, his brother was a naturalized citizen, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was granted citizenship.
My guests are Scott Hellman and Jenna Russell. Their book, Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice, published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the police had swept the area for bombs before the race, and they came up with nothing. Was that normal procedure?
Yeah, certainly since 9/11 happened, all large events like this in public, you're going to see preparation and precaution. It's just the problem is that you can't defend against someone who walks into the marathon with a backpack.
And this is the magic of the marathon, right? For people who don't know it, it's not a closed sporting event. I mean, you literally have 52 plus miles of area where you've got spectators. And that's what's so great, because you bring your kids down, you can sit on the course, you can put your knees in the course. It's this open, you know, running celebration throughout Boston. And so, you know, protecting that is very difficult, and infiltrating it is very easy.
Do you know what plans are being made for this year's race?
Yeah, they're significantly different. I mean, they're trying to preserve the spirit of the marathon, that open spirit, the welcoming spirit, but certainly there are some practical changes. I think runners are no longer able to bring bags. I think there will be more checkpoints. I think large strollers, they're telling people not to bring. I mean, I think people will feel a much different marathon, but hopefully have a very similar experience as in years past.
Getting back to the release of the photograph, some people believe that that led directly to the death of MIT police officer Sean Collier, who the brothers killed in an apparent attempt to steal his gun. Do law enforcement today believe that it was still the right decision?
I think they do. I mean, certainly there was a risk involved in putting the pictures out there and to tipping these guys off that they were after him. I think, you know, the benefits in their mind outweighed the risks. And yes, in some ways you can say, well, this set in motion all these things that happened. But we also don't know what would have happened had they not done that. Would they have gone on to New York and detonated a bomb here in Times Square? You know, who knows?
Well, in one of the book's most harrowing passages, you tell the story of Danny, the man the Tsarnaevs carjacked. What happened to him?
He's got this amazing story. So you have this 26-year-old Chinese engineer who's working for a startup. He's out for a joyride in his Mercedes because he loves cruising. This is how he relaxes. It's late at night on Thursday. He pulls over to the side of the road to send a text message, very wisely, by the way. He's not texting and driving. He feels a rap on his window. He thinks, maybe I hit this car and didn't notice. Next thing he knows, Tamerlan has opened the door, gotten in, pointing a gun at him and saying, we're going for a ride. And over the next 90 minutes, there's this incredible – I mean, it's just amazing to think about it now. I mean, they lead Danny. Danny's driving for a time, then Tamerlan's driving. It's kind of unclear what they're doing. They're sort of driving in circles. They're looking for gas. They're talking about going to New York. Ultimately, Danny has the presence of mind in probably the only moment he could have done this to slip out of the car when the gun is not in Tamerlan's hand, dash across the street to a gas station, call the police. At Danny's insistence, the police call Mercedes, the navigation system from the store, because he's saying, you can track them, call it, I have Embrace. You know, that's, they'll know where the car is.
This is one of the few times when we're happy that we can be tracked.
Exactly, yes. It was the big brother came in very handy in that case. And in fact, that was the first time all week that they had finally had a beat on these brothers.
And then that led to the Watertown confrontation?
Exactly. And so when they track the car is heading westbound toward Watertown, a reasonably nice small community northwest of Boston that certainly never sees firefights and rarely ever sees officers even fire their gun. That really brings police together with these suspects for the first time. They have this vicious firefight. They're throwing bombs. They're firing at them. This leads to basically the end of the story that week.
Well, there's a lot of chaos. But it's also some people believe that a Boston police officer was shot, nearly killed by friendly fire.
Yes, the witness accounts suggest pretty consistently that that was probably the case. You had officers from all over the region descending upon this quiet residential neighborhood, and they didn't know the area. They were spread about almost in a circle firing. It was, in some ways, it was a recipe for disaster, and there's a sense that, you know, worse things could have come of it.
Well, then there was the controversial lockdown of Watertown.
That was one of the craziest days I think any one of us will ever experience. And I think when you ask people,
were you
today,
there?
I was there in Watertown that day. But you didn't have to be in Watertown. I think anyone in that area, if you ask people today, well, what do you remember about that week? Most people will tell you that they remember that Friday because it was an eerie day where the city had shut down, the transit system is shut down. We describe it in the book as this enormous pregnant moment, because you knew that there was going to be some kind of conclusion. You just didn't know what it was going to be. And to have everybody locked in their houses, to see SWAT teams running up and down the streets, knocking on doors, looking in attics, I mean, it was deeply unnerving. And I think when it finally came to an end and they had Jahar captured, that sense of euphoria and relief was unlike, I think, anything we will ever see again, because it was so universally shared. And it was something everybody was following.
Although Jahar was found not by the police.
Exactly. And it's shocking now if you go to see how close it was from the distance where he left the car to where he was found. I think that was one of the things that we looked at in the book. When you're thinking about lessons for next time, they had promised that the searches were airtight. And I don't think they quite were. I think they did a lot of great work. But that was one thing that was not as quite as they promised.
Well, Jahar had been wounded. And he was just looking for a place to hide, like a wounded animal.
Sure, but if you go out now and talk to people in that neighborhood, there's a lot of concern about what happened within that search. that caused this homeowner to ramble out into his backyard and make this discovery.
How often is the death penalty used in Boston? Have there been any or in Massachusetts in general? Have there been any executions in recent years?
Boy, I don't think so.
So, but this is a death penalty case. Would it be tried as a federal case or as
right.
a local case?
Right. It's a federal case, which is why the death penalty is an option there. We have, you know, well, a lot of opposition to the death penalty. And I think in a poll that the Globe did in the fall, only a third of Massachusetts residents were actually in favor of the death penalty in this case. And the rest were against it or undecided. So it's an interesting place for this to play out.
Well, I'm assuming that the two of you will be covering the trial.
Most likely.
I think we'll be involved to some degree.
So
absolutely. There's a lot left to tell about this story. You know, we did our best to tell everything we could within that year, and we wanted it to be out by the year anniversary, but this story is far from over.
And I'm assuming that somewhere down the line there'll be a new and updated version of this book.
I think that's a reasonable bet, though.
Yes.
I don't think we're quite ready to talk about that yet.
Not today.
Well, is it still painful to think about what happened? You had to revisit the site of the marathon and all of the other terrible things that happened. On some level, I'm sure it brings back really bad memories.
It was difficult, but I think one thing that we discovered in the course of reporting for the book is how many remarkable stories there are here that show people connecting with each other and supporting each other and just bringing their depths of humanity underneath the drama of this story that I think are worth discovering.
Jenna Russell, Scott Hellman, reporters for the Boston Globe, their book, Long Mile Home, Boston Under Attack, The City's Courageous Recovery and the Epic Hunt for Justice. It's published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.